Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, let's see now. Where are we? Stocks and bonds, sneakers and robocabs, long-form journalism, and unemployment benefits on the broadcast today as well. Yeah, that pretty much covers it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday. It is the last Friday of 2013. Great, as always, to have you with us, no matter the date. We'll begin today with our weekly wrap, not just the 5 days gone by, but the 360 or so that came before it as well. For that, John Carney from CNBC is in our New York studios. It's just you and me today, John. You all right with that?
I've got a big surprise for you. We've got Lizzie O'Leary
no way,
right here.
No way, no way, no way. And here we were all set to go, just me and John. Lizzie, how are you?
I'm okay. The NYPD likes to hold up the subway train sometimes.
Little out of breath?
Yeah, a little bit.
All right, so I'll give the first question to Carney. You can catch your breath. John, I want to go back actually to last Friday. President Obama had his news conference before he went off to Hawaii for the holidays, and he said, and this is pretty much a quote, 2014 could be a breakout year for the American economy. I want to know from you, what has to happen for that to happen?
He could stay in Hawaii. look, the economy is doing very, very well. All that could happen now is things could get screwed up. But right now, the Fed is saying, look, we think things are going well. Most economists are saying things will go very well. So as long as we don't end up in some sort of epic political fight where we're going to tank the economy again, things will go well in 2014. This is great news. So, you know, maybe Obama, you know, take a little longer vacation.
But that's a big what if, John, if we don't wind up in some epic political battle. Ms. O'Leary, what say you? What
My
has to
jaw
happen?
Dropped when John said that.
Yeah.
You should have seen it. Look, yes, it would be great if there was no epic political battle. And they did have a budget agreement. We do have the debt ceiling hanging out there. Maybe they learned their lesson last time. Things do seem to be getting better. The pieces of data that have been coming in are positive. There is a question. Tomorrow, millions of Americans lose their unemployment insurance benefits. We'll see what happens when that happens. And I think there's a question of what happens to the unemployment rate going forward. That's certainly something that the Fed's going to be looking at, though they have said, yes, we hope to continue to taper.
Right. Okay. So, well, two things. One, great segue. Thank you. And on the taper, because that's where we're going next. But also, we've got Mitchell Hartman coming up on unemployment right after we chat. But John, let me ask you something. And it's going to be a little bit of raining on the parade here, right? We do have the taper in place. The Fed is pulling back on its support for the economy, although it's still plowing billions of dollars in there. Interest rates are nudging up. The 10-year is over 3%, and I know it's a small rise. Is there not – oh, and stock markets are going through the roof. Is there not just a slightest feeling that we're set for a fall?
Look, we are probably going to have some sort of pullback in 2014. The stock market has been on a tear. I think the stock market is a pretty good predictor of what's going to happen in the economy. And what it's telling us, if it is a good predictor, is that 2014 should be a pretty good year, despite the fact that the Fed is tapering. The Fed went up – the stock market went up almost every day since the Fed announced the taper, except for today. It dipped a little, you know, because people are like, oh, you know, I'm going to be away for a few days.
Even if bond rates – you know, even if yields go up a little bit more, that's still not a lot of return. So people are going to put their money somewhere. Maybe it's still in the stock market, though I agree it's very, very high. Maybe that's an emerging market.
But I think actually what's happening, though, is that the stock market is telling us not just that – I think the stock market might pull back. But I think the broader economy is going to do pretty well. And that's what this rise of 2013 is telling us about what will happen in the broader economy in 2014. We will have growth. It's going to be a pretty good year.
All right. And yeah, I heard a Lizzie sign. O'Leary sign there.
Have you
I heard
ever
me
heard me
sign
say
there.
That?
Yeah, I know. But I don't know. It's the holiday spirit in you, John. All right. Before I let you guys go, Lizzie, the biggest story of this year, what was it, business and economy-wise?
Well, you know me. I still have a soft spot. I think the biggest story to me is there is a split, a schism, if you will, mm-hmm. between where data show the economy is going and where people's hearts wage power for the middle class feels mm-hmm. where the economy is in their gut. I think that's a huge disconnect, and I think that schism is incredibly important.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. John, your story of the year?
I'm going to cheat and pick two. The stock market in general, one of the best years we've ever had in history. It's amazing. It is incredible. I almost pulled out all my investments back in May because I thought it was going too well. And then the second story is Twitter. The IPO that shouldn't have worked. Tech should have blown up already, but it's going bananas. So those are the two stories.
Except for today, and we'll get to that in the numbers. All right, John Carney from CNBC and Lizzie O'Leary from us. And I should point out, by the way, pulling double duty this week, helping us out this afternoon and hosting the morning show. You guys have a good weekend, all right?
Thanks, Guy.
Happy New Year.
We'll see you. Be good. On Wall Street today, as John mentioned, red arrows all the way around, but only by the narrowest of margins. Details, numbers, you know the drill. As Lizzie was talking about, this is going to be a tough weekend for the 1.3 million Americans who've been collecting extended unemployment benefits. That is, for more than 6 months. Funding to keep those checks coming, about $25 billion plus or minus, wasn't part of the budget deal that Congress made a couple of weeks ago. So the program stops cold tomorrow, although Democrats do say they will try to renew the emergency benefits when they get back to work after New Year's. In the meanwhile, though, there is a whole lot of money that's not getting out into the economy. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman looks at how that's going to play out.
The cutoff hurts most in the states with the highest long-term unemployment, like Illinois.
We're still seeing plants closing, seeing a lot of business leaving the area.
Dusty Miller is 51 and lives near Rockford, Illinois, unemployment 10.5%. He was director of defense contracts at an airline that shut down last February. His unemployment runs out early next year.
Fortunately, I was in a position where we had planned for this and had money tucked away for it.
At least for now.
Worst case, I'd go out and work at a 7-Eleven or something if I had to.
At Totally You Hair Salon in Rockford, manager Tammy Parker says she doesn't see a lot of drop-off among her middle-class clientele.
I think if I've seen any kind of a slump, it's been in our estheticians. People are maybe not getting a facial that they might have treated themselves to prior.
Out in San Bernardino, California, unemployment 9.8%. Troy Ballard at Troy's Beauty and Barber Salon says his business will definitely suffer.
It impacts us greatly because if you're not employed, you can't get your hair done.
Ballard hears plenty of stories in the chair, so he knows right away if someone's hit a rough patch.
Even sometimes, you know, if I had a customer that's been coming to me on a regular basis, if they would lose their job, you know, I still try to let them keep coming. You know, they're still going out and getting interviews.
That'll allow them to spend whatever they have on necessities, food, rent, utilities. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As we close out the last full work week of 2013, thoughts invariably turn to the future, both near-term and far. Almost by definition, anything is possible in the times to come, including driverless cars. Google said earlier this year that it could have automated cars on the streets by 2017, not that far away. About which, 2 points, though. One, what could possibly go wrong? Number two, driverless cars that carry paying passengers surely won't be far behind. John Sepulvedo has the story of Uber and the robocabs.
Right now, Uber acts like a taxi cab you hail from your smartphone. You use an app to call a car, and a driver brings that car to you. That simplicity has earned the company a lot of fans, including Amber Leonti. She lives in Sacramento.
With their app, it's so easy, and it'll tell you what cars are in range, what your driver's name is. I love that.
One time, Leonti used Uber 3 times in the same day, and she kept getting the same driver. At first, Leonti says the driver was real perky and happy. But later in the night,
he had about 8 king-size candy wrappers that he was offering us as, like, that's how he was getting through his evening. I didn't take it because I don't take candy from strangers, but I like that he was fueling himself on sugar.
But what if a driver didn't have to fuel himself at all? Because what if the driver was a robot? If you listen to Uber CEO Travis Kalanick speaking at a tech conference earlier this year, it sounds like that's where his company is headed. Robocabs, without drivers, taking people where they want to go.
We're in the business of delivering cars. We're delivering a car to you that you then can do whatever you want with.
And as far as those drivers go,
Well, the car has a driver as well.
Well, for now at least, Uber has gotten almost $250 million in investment money from Google, and the tech giant has been a leader in developing self-driving cars. And robocabs would essentially be self-driving cars used for commercial purposes. They would use lasers and cameras to navigate the city streets. And that's bad news for human drivers. On average, these drivers make about $11 an hour. But Mark Rogowski, a tech writer with Forbes, says those jobs will be lost when robocabs hit the roads.
I think that whether the self-driving car shows up in 5 or 10 years, once it does, the cab driver is an endangered species.
Taxi driver Travis Johnson heads the San Francisco Cab Drivers Association, and he says cab drivers will actually be safer than automated cars.
The big problem with eliminating a driver is the automated vehicle can't make snap judgments for, you know, safety or route. Like, you might have to break a law in order to safely avoid an accident.
Yet tech experts aren't buying that. They say as more automated cars hit the road, the safer the cars will be, mainly because they'll be able to talk to each other in bumper-to-bumper traffic and when changing lanes. Some expect the first robocabs to be on the road in as soon as 5 years. But that question of safety is still a big concern for the insurance industry. Pete Moraga is with the Insurance Information Network of California. He says insurers will have a hard time figuring out how much risk automated cars pose.
And in this case, it's going to take a while. So there has to be that transition period where these cars get on the streets, whether they're robo cabs or personal cars, and we have a history of how they operate.
Many in the insurance industry expect that it'll be more than a decade before you can log into Uber, order a cab, and be whisked away by a self-driving car. I'm John Sepulvedo for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's not true that people will only read short things online, and it's not true that people's attention spans have evaporated.
Huh? What? Oh, I'm sorry. I drifted off. No, I'm just kidding. Long-form journalism is making a comeback. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down just a point, closed at 416,478. The NASDAQ down 10 points. See? Drifted off, didn't I? The NASDAQ down 10 points, 0.25%, finished at 4156. The S&P 500 shed less than a point as well, just a fraction of 1%, ended things at 1841. For the week gone by, the Dow up 1.6%. The NASDAQ and S&P both gained 1.3% today over the week. Shares in General Motors downshifted 1.4% after GM's joint venture in China said it would recall close to 1.5 million vehicles because of potential safety issues. Remember that big run-up in Twitter that Carney was talking about? Yeah, not so fast, Big John. Investors gave some of that back today. Twitter shares off 13%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note, hey, look at that, up to 3.005%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace. So please help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors issues its pending home sales index for November. It's the 50th anniversary of the premiere of Let's Make a Deal, the television game show people really dress up for. And helping Californians get around, the Arroyo Seco Parkway officially opened on December 30th, 1940. It connects Pasadena and Los Angeles and was the first freeway in the western U.S. I bet traffic was a bit lighter back then. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. McDonald's has pulled the plug on McResources, its nominally internal website for employees. Workers could get help there on everything from eating right to saving money, in theory. What really happened was that McResources became very McBad McPR for the company, because the fact is the line between internal and external has become treacherously thin in corporate America. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has the story.
There were tweets, there were videos, there were news stories. McDonald's tells employees to try food stamps. Ronald McDonald tells workers not to eat fast food. It was a PR nightmare.
There's always been information that the company didn't want to get out, but now it's just so much easier to get it out.
Lisa Orndorff is with the Society for Human Resources Management. She says over the years, more and more companies have tried to clamp down on leaks with things like confidentiality agreements. Jonah Berger teaches at the Wharton School.
Justin Bieber did something similar for a party. You know, he had a party at his house. He said, hey, if you're going to be here, you got to sign a confidentiality agreement, $3 million if you break it.
But this all comes down to something much bigger, PR. Companies need more of it. It's no longer just the outside face of the firm that needs managing. Darren Brabham is with the USC Annenberg School.
You know, internal communication or employee communication or employee relations used to be this one domain of public relations, which frankly, was not necessarily ignored, but not emphasized either.
That was before the age of viral ridicule. Now companies can find themselves retweeted to the front page of BuzzFeed and a 500,000 Facebook pages in minutes. Every bad tweet can become a PR fail.
It's much more of a micro-level management of individual relationships because those things can then, you know, tip out of control on social media and go viral.
So what does this brave new world of digital peril mean? A lot of new PR jobs. The industry grew 8% last year. I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
If you're so big a basketball fan that you watch the marathon schedule of NBA games on Christmas Day, you probably already know two of the sport's biggest stars are out with injuries, Derrick Rose and Kobe Bryant. That is bad news not just for the Bulls and the Lakers, but for Adidas and Nike as well, because both of those guys have new lines of shoes out on the market. Still, the fast break of sales for basketball sneakers will continue. It hit $3.7 billion last year, thanks in no small part to players attaching their names to a brand. From WBUR in Boston, Doug Tribou looks at two old-school endorsement deals that changed the industry.
Before there were Air Jordans, long before, there were Chuck Taylors. The best-selling sneakers of all time started out as cutting-edge basketball technology nearly 100 years ago. They bear the name of a Hall of Famer, but the shoes' days on the hardwood are over.
I like to say the Chuck Taylor All-Star was born on the basketball courts, raised by rock and roll, and really adopted by street culture and fashion over the years.
Magnus Wedhammer is the vice president of Converse All-Star. Converse, which is owned by Nike, sells about 70 million pairs of the canvas sneakers worldwide every year. But who was the man behind the signature on the iconic ankle patch?
Chuck Taylor himself was really the first endorsed performance athlete back in the day.
Charles Taylor was born in Indiana in 1901. He played high school basketball and later some semi-pro ball. Wedhammer says the All-Star sneaker was already on the market when Converse hired Taylor as a salesman in 1922.
And he really helped evolve the All-Star to the Chuck Taylor All-Star over time.
Taylor put on basketball clinics all over the country, selling sneakers to high school and college teams. His name was added to the ankle patch in 1932. Abraham Amador wrote the biography, Chuck Taylor All-Star.
People who were buying his shoes by the 60s, 70s, 80s and beyond, they just thought of Chuck Taylor as a brand. But there really was such a person as Chuck Taylor.
But when Taylor died in 1969, his sneaker was in crisis. So Converse turned to Dr. J.
Leading the break the distance, Julius Erving!
Converse actually called me in to talk to their engineers.
Julius Erving wore All-Stars from his childhood right through his college career. But when he turned pro in the 1970s, Dr. J endorsed new leather Converse sneakers. Adidas and Puma already sold leather basketball shoes, and Converse needed to catch up.
And we spent a lot of hours in terms of the design and obviously feel and comfort and durability.
All of that helped pave the way for Michael Jordan's groundbreaking partnership with Nike in 1984. According to Sports One source, today the Jordan brand controls more than half of the basketball market. Overall, Nike holds a 92% share.
By being able to take the person and then ultimately become the brand, that's a very rare exception.
Marshall Cohen is the chief retail analyst at the NPD Group. He says 75% of all basketball sneakers are purchased for style, not performance, in part because of retro reissues.
It's all about brand, and it's all about celebrity product.
Fans aren't the only ones picking up Air Jordans. Other elite athletes, like the NBA's Blake Griffin and baseball's Derek Jeter, are happy to sign with Jordan's team and to wear his name and silhouette, too.
Jordan, as a brand, will certainly outlive Jordan the player.
On the court, LeBron James, another Nike spokesman, has a chance to equal Jordan's accomplishments. But don't expect King James, or anyone else, to knock Jordan off the throne of sneaker endorsements anytime soon. In Boston, I'm Doug Tribou for Marketplace.
If you're a reader of news in general, you may have noticed a bevy of multi-part stories of late. Long-form journalism, that's sometimes called. It's in print, always has been. Newspapers hustling to win Pulitzers, magazines being magazines. But those big meaty stories are starting to show up in unlikely places. Online, on sites that have built their brand on listicles and slideshows, and on some new sites with all new business models. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has our medium-length story.
Long-form journalism is trendy, but it isn't new. Think magazine writing. Today, we've given it an earnest name and saddled it with a collective hope that it'll save our brains from the viral videos and snarky commentary that dominate the internet. When we talk about long-form, we're talking often about narrative storytelling, craft journalism. Stories like this from freelance journalist Brooke Jarvis.
Many of the graves had no headstones at all, just white wooden crosses with names stenciled in black paint. These were clearly among the most recent memorials. The earth beneath them was still heaped up, still decorated with bedraggled stuffed animals and faded plastic flowers, unopened beers with rusty caps.
Stories where you settle in, relax, are transported.
There were large and small cemeteries all over the peninsula. Some only recently.
Brooke's story is titled When We Are Called to Part. It's about her experiences in a settlement for leprosy patients in a remote part of Hawaii.
Definitely what I like doing best is when you really have the time and space to dive deeply into a topic.
And it's a relatively good time to be that kind of writer. The number of online sites publishing long-form stories is growing. Jarvis is able to make a go as a freelancer, working with non-traditional online outlets like The Atavist, which published her story. Evan Ratliff is The Atavist co-founder.
We launched 3 years ago, and I think at that time we felt like we had to make this argument that it's not true that people will only read short things online, and it's not true that people's attention spans have evaporated.
The Atavist publishes stories between 5,000 and 30,000 words. For a little perspective, that could be more than 1,000 tweets, 6 pages of newsprint.
Something you can read in anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour and a half.
The Atavist charges per story. It splits profit with the author. It also makes money selling software that helps other websites publish long stories with multimedia elements.
You know, you could sort of throw a rock on the web and hit a publication that's trying to do long-form writing.
This, he says, is fantastic. There are dedicated sites like The Atavist and sites like BuzzFeed and Politico mixing longer journalism with quick hits and snappy headlines. They're bread and butter. Susan Glasser is the editor of Politico's new magazine.
Their ambition from the beginning has been to drive and to own the Washington conversation.
Making the move into longer form journalism, she says, is natural. The first cover story of the print magazine was a 7,500-word piece about the Obama White House. Glasser says it got 1 million page views.
I do think that there's a sense that it's hopefully going to be good business for Politico to find ways to pull out of that news cycle and to dominate the Washington conversation in a whole different way.
These stories help build a brand. Patty Walter is a professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University.
And longer, in-depth stories have a layer of gravitas and smarts to them that allow media outlets to sort of stake a claim in the intellectual space.
They give the publication and the journalist an aura of importance, significance. Long-form stories at their best reveal bigger truths. They also win awards.
To be a media outlet that can do that and compete at that level is one of the, it's the pinnacle of the craft.
So goodbye conventional wisdom that the internet has killed journalism, that all we want is slideshows of baby hamsters. And hello depth and length. Hello storytelling. Now you're going to have to earn and keep our time and attention. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, news from reality television. A&E announced this afternoon that Phil Robertson and the whole Duck Dynasty gang are coming back. Filming starts in the spring. Robertson was put on, as you'll recall, indefinite hiatus earlier this month for comments that were controversial, to be extremely polite. Anyway, A&E now says, and this is a quote, "Duck Dynasty is not a show about one man's views. It resonates with a large audience because it is a show about family, a family, the network says, that America has come to love." A&E also said it's going to launch a public service ad campaign promoting, and again, this is a quote, "unity, tolerance, and acceptance among all people." Well, you can quote me on this. That's Marketplace from APM on this Friday. Our theme music is composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitara Sherstinsky. You try saying that 10 times fast. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend, huh? This is APM.